this afternoon, and Willie said, "You're like the judgment. It's frequently prophesied, but you're mighty slow in getting here." And all of a sudden, that makes me feel that I ought to explain that somehow or other. I am a professor, and that's my first reason. That means that I'm just plain forgetful. If my wife or Arlene don't tell me something, I forget. So I forgot what the time was I was supposed to be here. Also, I think I'd like to mention what happened yesterday, just to show you that at least there was some reason for not coming up a little earlier. I thought of this tonight when Willie made the comment about judgment. In the morning yesterday, two gentlemen from Washington, D.C., and one from the western region of one of the government offices dropped in to see a few of us at the university and said we'd like to give you some money, up to $450,000 if you want it. That's a lot of money, to me in a way. And what we want you to do is to design a program for a pilot city, Seattle, which will eliminate crime. Now that's no bargain. That's worth $450. It would be a bargain if you could bring it off. But at any price. That is a serious problem. And since I noticed on the bulletin board that I've been scheduled for a couple hours, one tomorrow and one Saturday, one of those days I think we ought to talk about that. Crime in our community and where the law is and what kind of contribution it might make and what kind of a contribution we might make. Yesterday afternoon, after sort of halfway committing myself to get rid of crime, at least in Seattle, I went downtown and met with two lawyers and two other men representing a lawyer and a man from labor on one side and a lawyer and a man from management on the other side. My interest in this arose starting last year when we had a bit of difficulty in the city of Seattle where some people in the minority community thought that it was reasonable that some persons who were not Caucasian ought to be admitted to some of the construction trades, apprentices and journeymen. And there was a fuss, and ultimately there was a lawsuit, and after the lawsuit, the federal judge in our district, Judge Lindberg, appointed a committee which was supposed to figure out how to bring this miracle to happen. And after the committee, which was composed of interested people, that is, members from the minority community, and the labor and the management elements spent 3 or 4 months fighting with each other. The judge decided that he needed a neutral referee, and on the theory that I might be neutral, he asked me to chair that committee. And yesterday we went through one of our periodic bouts where you spend time sort of heaping anger on each other. A tough time making our groups work in our society today. Management labor is a little bit like other kinds of marriages that are necessary in our society. There are certain operations which have to continue. Now, if a lessor and a lessee, a tenant and a landlord, don't like each other, they can fix that. The tenant can move out and they can go their separate ways, but management labor can't do that. Husband and wife can't really do that. And these groups that we think of as being sort of basic building blocks in a culture like ours, somehow or other we have to devise a scheme that will make it possible for us to help affirmatively work out solutions. That's what Judge Lindberg is trying to do with his device. And it's working somewhat. But I think we ought to talk about that too. And so on either Friday or Saturday, in one order or another, I'd like to talk about units, primarily family units, because that's the most basic, and where we are, where the law is. And then the other day I'd like to talk about misbehavior, deviance, unexpected kind of activity. But before we can do that, I think it becomes important that we try and understand a little bit about what law is, and what it can do and what it can't do, and how it operates a little bit. And so if we can talk about that some tonight as kind of background for the other two discussions. And I would like for this to be a discussion. Let me kick off a few ideas, and then if you want to, please interrupt and agree, disagree, question anything you like. You can't possibly distract me because I don't know yet what I'm going to talk about. By the time that Jim got through with us in Vespers tonight, I was thinking once more about Willie and his judgment slow in coming, and also joy, because that certainly was what we were talking about tonight. And for some reason, which I'm not quite sure why, I started thinking about a passage which appears either in Ezekiel or Isaiah. Willie could probably tell us, I can't remember. The prophet is instructing the children of Israel how they ought to behave when they are finally captured and dragged off to Babylon. Babylon, the scourge of civilization, in what must have been a terribly bloody fight, grabbing these people and into the captivity you go. All of the bestiality and brutality that war has always meant to people. The first instruction that's given is when you are dragged off into captivity in Babylon, pray for the city. That's not what I was taught when I was in the military. I was taught that I had, if captured, two responsibilities: escape and destroy. That's not what the prophet said. He said, pray for the city. And the second instruction, as I recall it, and I haven't attempted to find this tonight, you might look it up sometime, was that while you are in captivity, let your sons and your daughters marry, establish a business, plant your crops, carry on life. Because in a sense, this was a judgment that actually came, Willie. That one arrived. It was a judgment, you see. And it also was a mission. Sometimes we get dragged into missions by judgments, I suspect quite frequently. And then that passage in the prophet, and I wish that I did have it so I could read it now to be sure that I know what I'm talking about from memory, says that when judgment comes to that city, to Babylon, that then this visible body of Christ, the church, the remnant, the visible, all the known visible body of Christ, will go forth from that city at the time that the city falls, and when you can't help anymore, when it's all over, when you're through, see, when you can't help anymore, when judgment has finally and irrevocably come, then the church goes forth from that city. The words are like a he-goat on the mountain, leading its flock. And you know, I was struck by that, because if the whole visible church is the lead goat, and it's being followed by a flock, whom thunders the flock? It obviously must be drawn out of our society somewhere. Well, what's that got to do with things that the law has to do with? It seems to me that it's instructive for us to start thinking about this business of praying for the city and planting crops and marrying and establishing businesses and living and while we are in, although not of, Babylon, the society in which we live. As a lawyer, I feel this way about the law. And I would like to spend the next few minutes trying to disabuse some notions which I think we in the church have held for far too long about law and what it is, and possibly start constructing some notions about law and what it is and how it operates. We talk a lot about rights in our society. We talk about people having rights to employment, rights to adequate standard of living, We talk about rights under various pieces of legislation. Sometimes we even talk about human rights. The Pope, a few years ago, in an encyclical, Peace on Earth, said that he thought that every human being had the right to adequate food and shelter and services, education.
And that's flawed, actually, ever since the Pope said that, because I don't believe it.
I don't believe that used in the legal sense of right, that's an accurate statement. I don't know what you mean when you say right, but a lawyer uses that term to be the correlative of a duty. If you have a right, I or someone has a duty. That is to say, if you have a right to $1,000, you can go before an established body, a judicial body, a judge, an administrative tribunal, or something of this sort, say your piece, and that body will then say to the person who is the defendant who is answering it, you have a duty to pay $1,000 to that man. And if you don't do it, I'll send out the man in blue with a nightstick, and he will work you over until you pay. Or we'll take your house or something. Justice Holmes once observed that a right without a remedy is an impossibility. If you don't have a remedy, you don't have a right. That's what the man said. If you can't enforce it, if you can't implement it, it doesn't exist. I don't believe that either. Because I think there are all kinds of things that we are forced to describe as rights that I can't take to a judge and have it implemented. That's why I told you a little bit about the labor union situation. That's one of those things. My interest in that situation is simply to see to it that a given number of persons from the minorities are taken into a certain number of trades as apprentices, ultimately as journeymen. They will be given an education, given an opportunity to develop the skills that they have to have. You know, you can't do that by a court order. You can create some openness and some opportunities, but in the last analysis, there has to be engendered a kind of an attitude, a willingness to cooperate, a desire to do these things, or else ultimately you're into a situation where you try to enforce blow by blow and step by step something which simply cannot be brought about that way. So I now the place where I can suggest to you that we'd be better off if we got a little bit more particular in talking about the kind of rights that we speak of rather glibly from time to time. I'd like to suggest to you now that for purposes of talking about the Christian in society, the state and the church, or the church in Babylon, what it can do, that we ought to think of three kinds of rights. And let me simply label them for a moment as being legal rights and constitutional rights and human rights. Okay? And let's try and be faithful to our notion that a right is a meaningful concept only if there is a answering responsibility, an answering duty of some sort. I mention legal rights first because they are far and away the most simple. I don't know how you would define law if I asked you now, what is law? If you want to talk about legal rights, obviously we have to talk about law. I think most of you think that law is a collection of rules. I think that's what you think. I think most of you would believe that when a legislative body goes into session and grinds out a bunch of rules, that they are announcing the law. I think you think that because that's usually what it says on the book, you know, the laws of 1971, or according to the law, you are not supposed to go more than 35 miles an hour, or whatever it may be. Well, it's a common usage. We do speak of the rule as a law. Yet that's very sloppy and very bad. If you looked in one of my dictionaries in the law school for a definition of law, you would find something like this. Law is a process for subjecting the affairs of men to orderly management. Something along that line. It's a process. It's a way of doing something. It's a method. It's a technique for accomplishing certain goals. Usually goals that have to do with arguments, disagreements, the places where people's perception of what they ought to do come into conflict with each other very sharply. And most of law is categorized that way. Landlord against the tenant, buyer against the seller, tortfeasor against the tortfeasee, state against the criminal. Always it's somebody against somebody. Law is always conflict. Person who's regulating against the person who's regulated, so forth. And it isn't every kind of an argument that becomes a legal question in this sense, because most of the things that we do in our lives are done out of either habit or they're done out of a kind of a common agreement that we all have accepted a long time ago, and we don't need any particular instruction, we don't need any coercion or any force to make us behave that way. Now and then we get into a disagreement about something. You know, maybe I say that the boundary line between my yard and your yard is here, and you say, no, it's there. And we have an argument. And maybe we can't settle that one. Well, 999 out of 1,000 arguments that I may have with you, we can settle. One way or another, we can go look up the deed book and find out where the boundary line is. We can get a survey done, something of that sort. And when the evidence is clear enough that one answer is the right answer, the correct answer, the persuasive answer, where reasonable minds can't disagree about that, then we resolve, you and I resolve our questions individually. Now and then, and very rarely, you as a reasonable man and I as a reasonable man will talk about this and we will come into a kind of a disagreement that we can't resolve. So it may be that we will then take this to some professional argument settlers, lawyers, who will then start speaking various forms of gibberish and looking at old books. And again, 999 times out of the thousands, the lawyers will be able to predict with enough accuracy how a judge would decide that if you took it to a judge, so that it isn't worth taking it to the judge. Because if you know what he's going to do, it's no use suing. That's just a waste of time and money. Now and then, the lawyers can't agree because the facts are not that clear, or the rule is not that clear, because those are the things that a judgment is made out of, facts and rules. And you can have disagreement either as to the interpretation of that rule or as to the analysis of facts. And where reasonable minds differ and where reasonable attorneys, motivated by not wanting to lose a case, still differ, and each one believes that he's right and the other guy is wrong, they'll take it to a judge. About 999 cases out of 1,000 that go to pleadings are settled before a trial is ever held. I'm trying now to give you a visual picture of a pyramid, starting out with multiple thousands of disagreements that we have in our communities, and finally getting up to a little teeny pinnacle of questions that have to go to a legal process for a judge to decide. And of course, out of those that go to a trial in the trial courts, very, very few are appealed. And an appealed case is about the first time that you ever have a written judgment. And quite frequently, when there's a written judgment by an appellate court, if there are 9 judges, they decide it by something like 5-4 or 6-3. What I'm trying to get you to see at this point is for anyone to say that that rule at that point, that decision, is clear, is asinine. Obviously, any little shift in the facts or any little shift in the interpretation of the rule can give you a different decision. In the legal process, the legal process, the law, the process of resolving issues. What we are trying to do is to devise a means of getting enough clarity about how words and the rule is going to be interpreted and how facts are going to be proven, what's going to be taken as evidence that's admissible and persuading, so that we can predict how that case would be decided and thus give people enough assurance, predictability, so that they can get on with their business because they know how the argument would be resolved. That makes predictability a very important thing in law. But of course, at precisely the same time, we all know that if our law is like the law of the Medes and Persians, which changes not, that pretty soon we are in an absolute bind, because law must change as the environment changes. We have lots of archaic laws in our books. There is still, I believe, an ordinance in the County of King, which requires that whenever I travel between Seattle and Tacoma, that when I get to the other side, that I shall go into the chief of police and I will report to him whether I saw any indications of Indian uprising. If I did that, I probably wouldn't get out of the pulpit for the next couple of weeks. Well, all right then, maybe you will grant me without a lot of hassling about it that it's very important that the law change dynamically. As the society becomes more and more dynamic, the change in the law, the rules, have to become more and more dynamic. And maybe you would grant me, without too much time being spent in illustration here, that we must not let ourselves get hung up on the notion that the rule, any rule, is immutable, unchangeable, everlasting, not if it's a legal rule. Now, at this point, I could sort of play the suicide role and say, and of course that includes the Ten Commandments. If it's law, we can talk some more about that when we talk about crimes, when we talk about the relationship of people in units, because after all, the Ten Commandments are very much aimed at deviance and loving relationships in reverse order. Law, then, pure law, must have a lot to do with judged utility. What'll work? That's what we're after. How can we get on with our business? When the United States cut its first canal for barges, the Erie Canal, if you've read the history of that time, you will find those fascinating illustrations of the barge captains who come down to the lock with their barges. And because there was no Interstate Commerce Commission and no Swede with a bullhorn out there to tell them which one went through the locks first, very frequently when two barges got there at the same time, a fist fight would become the way of deciding who got to go through the lock first. Now that's a terrible way to run a canal system. I suggest to you the same thing is true of Vietnam. It's a terrible way to resolve disputes. I have a friend who was in the Second World War, as I was. He happens to have been in the Marines. I was in the Air Force. Therefore, he had a much better public relations department than I did. At the time of the invasion of Iwo Jima, during the time they were hitting the beaches, the Marines ran up to my friend, who was a lawyer, and stuck the microphone of the kind of prototypes of tape recorders they were using in those days and said, "Lieutenant, what's your impression of all of this bloodshed?" And he, like a good lawyer, said, "I think this real estate problem ought to be settled in the courts." Now that's kind of an objective that you have. We'd like to get rid of crime. We'd like to get rid of alienation of groups of labor and minorities and husbands and wives and other people who don't like each other and can't get along, but that's putting a terrible burden on the legal system. The legal system has to do this schizophrenic bit about changing rapidly while it maintains its predictability unaltered. A psychiatrist who lectures in our law school occasionally says that the law school is perfectly designed to make nuts out of everybody who studies there. If you have irresolvable conflicts and demands. And of course, that's true. That's why lawyers will never pretend to give you an answer. You get only judgments and opinions. It's my judgment, it's my opinion. And so judgment here means quite a different thing than the judgment that we started talking about a little bit later. Is it different with constitutional law? You start talking about constitutional law, you immediately leave the rather precise levels of how fast shall you drive in this speed zone and how many percent may you charge by way of interest and what kind of a lease must you use in real property. The law, the strict law, the statutory and case law, tends to deal with rather finite, narrow, type decisions. Little questions, relatively little things. You get into constitutional law, you begin to branch out into overarching, sweeping principles. We have a lot of constitutional law in the United States. Canada has a lot of constitutional law. England has a lot of constitutional law. The interesting thing is that those states don't have any constitution, just constitutional law. Well, what is this constitutional law thing? Well, it is kind of an attempt for people to synthesize what's right and what's wrong, what's kind of comes closer to being immutable. And so we start talking about the big issues when we talk about constitutional law. We talk about things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the fact that no man will be thrown into prison without due process. Incidentally, do you know what due process is? The United States Supreme Court defined that a few years back by saying that when a man does not receive the process to which he is entitled, he has not received due process. And that is kind of the trademark of constitutional law. By definition, constitutional law has to be this open and this broad and this general. It has to be kind of a consensus of public opinion about what's right and what's wrong. And in one way, it's morality. And it's against immorality. And now see, I've used a couple words that none of us can define. I don't know what you think of when you think of morality. You may be thinking of filthy books or French postcards or something. I'm not thinking of that. I'm thinking of someone who suborns perjury. I mean, pays a juror some money to lie, to come out with a verdict, or someone who gets to a witness and bribes him to give testimony which is not accurate. That's immoral. And the reason that it's immoral is because it distorts the system which will help people reduce violence and arrive at agreement and get on with the job of planting crops and letting our sons and daughters marry and carrying on our day-to-day activities. Morality, in this sense, is nothing more than a violation of a law. It's a legal problem. And yet I suspect that most people today would talk about law and morality as being different problems. I do not see them as being different problems. I think we're still talking about the kind of rules and the kind of proof and the kind of prediction, the kind of systemizing, of organizing, the kind of process that I've been trying to sell to you as the notion of law. Well, think of something like the Golden Rule. That's a law. And a person who doesn't comply with that law, that rule, law in the rule sense, is being immoral. I have no fuss with that. But if you mean by immoral something which is essentially a spiritual problem, then I get very nervous about this. And the reason I get nervous about it is because now you must visualize a kind of a diagram that says the more precise you can be about giving instructions to people about what they should and shouldn't do, the more you are entitled to move in and correct that person in the event that he does not do what you've given him specific instructions about, And the less precise you can be about what he ought to do and how he ought to behave, the less right we have in society to try and move in and by coercion or imprisonment or fines or something else, the less right we have to try and coerce obedience, because we can't even make a good clean job of telling him what we want done. Illustration. A speed law is a fairly simple thing. If it says don't go over 35 miles an hour, that usually means don't go over 35 miles an hour. Not always. Obviously there are exceptions to that, sure. But generally that's what it means. When you get out to the other side that says that you can move in on a child and remove him from his parents and put him in an institution because he is, quote, in danger of growing up to lead an idle, dissolute, and immoral life, close quote. Quote from the law of the state of Washington, I defy you to define that for me. An idle, dissolute, and immoral life. According to a literal reading of the law, the state can take my children away from me because they are in danger of growing up to lead either an idle, a dissolute, or an immoral life, as you were in danger and I was in danger of that same thing. And I simply don't think that anyone could reasonably expect to have enforcement in the same degree, and that kind of a general principle, that kind of a moralistic statement that you have when you're down to the nitty-gritties about sign here, don't drive over 35 miles an hour, and use steel beams which will carry at least X tons of stress or something of that sort. It's measurable. The constitutional principles are in this sort of general moralistic. They're exhortations, and we use them rather cautiously then. So, for example, when someone says that this magazine is unfit to be seen by the public because it's pornographic, they are met by a constitutional principle. It says freedom of speech, freedom of expression. And you immediately get the characteristic of the law, the head-on clash of two competing forces, trying to do a good thing and trying to protect the good thing. And they are in conflict with each other, and somebody's got to make a decision. And that's a very tough decision. Now, you can gather facts and data about whether or not pictures and stories in magazines do or don't hurt people, until you become very old and very tired of that process, and you won't be much wiser than you are now. It's a very hard thing to demonstrate. And you can fuss with the First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of speech and trying to interpret that rule for a very long time either, and you're not going to get much more clarity out of the words. And what you then finally come down to is asking a judge or a court to make an extraordinarily difficult judgment, a decision about whether something ought to be protected or ought not to be protected. And here's the place in the constitutional principles where it's very important that we try to develop a system of adjudication that reflects our sense, our good judgment, our tolerance for each other. The joy that I have in the diversity of my country, the confidence that I have in your integrity, somehow or other the court has to reflect that in constitutional principles. That's why England, without a written constitution, can have constitutional cases in great number. You don't need a constitution. We're talking about something here which comes much closer to being an attempt to measure in judicial terms what our good sense about these problems is. There's a very basic lesson in there about law, and that is that we must not let ourselves believe that law in the tight legal sense or law in the constitutional sense is really sacred. I mean, the rules. The process, maybe, although I've got my doubts about that one, too. But certainly the rules are not. What we're doing is we're asking perfectly normal, fallible human beings to make judgments. And we're giving them some guidelines. But we get terribly nervous about that. And the reason that we get nervous about it is that we would prefer to think that law somehow or other is sacred or holy, or even that violation of law is sin, or some other idea like that, which I'm suggesting to you now is basically foolish. Where did we get this notion that law is so sacred, so holy? I suppose we've taught each other that in the church since we started talking to each other. But there's a good practical reason for it, too. When Moses took the children of Israel out of Egypt, out into the desert, whatever number of them there were, and I leave it to the theologians to tell me whether the right number is 1,250,000 or 3,500,000, was a lot of people would be wandering around in the wilderness. Even with a guy who was a good military genius and who had scanned that countryside with herds of sheep for about 40 years and probably knew where every water hole was and piece of food was there, still a pretty good trick to get those people out. Somewhere back around the 11th chapter of Numbers, Moses' father-in-law was coming to visit one day. You know, Moses married a girl who was the daughter of a desert chief, and like everyone else, he had to contend with in-laws. And on that particular day, Moses was sitting in his tent, and there were the long lines of litigants out there in front of him, arguing, I suppose, about things like, he stole my camel, she is making eyes at my husband, or whatever it may have been, the grievances which inevitably are going to arise with 1,250,000 people. He swiped my pot of water, or there went my manna, or whatever it was. And Moses, the poor guy, he's sitting there, you know, trying to, now, folks, let's become reconciled. And his father-in-law says, Moses, you got holes in your head, man. If you think you can do this job by yourself, what you need is a judicial system. You need somebody to help you with this burden of resolving the problems of your people, these conflicts. And Moses says, Dad, that sounds pretty great. How do you go about it? What do you need? And he says, well, you need two things. You need some judges and you need some rules. Judges I've got, says Moses. I appoint 70 right now. We'll call them the Sanhedrin, and then we'll set up some local JPs and things like that. Manpower I've got, but rules. What do I do about that? Rules. You know, if I just sit down and start writing rules, I've got enough trouble with these people right now. They're going to say to you, they're going to say to me, Moses, what makes your sociology so much better than mine, you know? Why should I obey your rules? I do not mean in any sense now to be sacrilegious. And I respect Moses immensely. You know, he did a tremendous job, granting that he picked up pieces of law from the Babylonians and from the Egyptians and from other sources. The form of a contract, you know, from the pre-Hittite society to Washington 1971 is essentially the same. We can't give Moses all of the credit for this, but at the same time, he did a tremendous job of converting the law from being purely coercive and punitive to a new level of humanity that had never been attained before. And he did making the people believe that they wanted to comply with the law. And one way that he did that was he went straight to headquarters for the rules. He did. I say, please, I don't mean to be sacrilegious here, but law must have a certain stripe of Barnum and Bailey in it. And Moses had it. Mountains which shook and lions that you dropped dead if you stepped over. And he came down from the shrouded mountain, and there it was. I don't write those. And so we today tell ourselves that the law is what governs us, and we're not governed by men. And we say the judges don't make up those rules. The rules are there, and the judges comply with them. And English judges and early American judges always insisted that the law was disclosed to them. They sat there on the woolsack and they gazed up into the clouds for this insoluble problem, you know, the kind that I've described to you, where neither reasonable men nor reasonable scholars in the law can agree as to how it ought to come out. And there's no factual information, and the scientists have gone aground, and there's no test that you can do, and all that you've got is irreconcilable conflict and prediction. And the judge would sit there and tilt back and look up into the sky, and pretty soon the answer would be disclosed to him. So he decides the case. And he'd never admit that he just made that up. He'd always say that he was doing it according to the law. And in a way, we've got to believe that, ladies and gentlemen, because if we don't believe that the judges are doing it according to the law, if you ever get to the place where you think that the judge is just making it up, why should you comply? So constitutional law in particular in the United States has generally been a conservative art. That is, the court hasn't wanted to answer questions. Because every time the court calls a shot on a tough one, it abrades its own credibility to a certain extent. Do you understand what I mean? In a society that moves rather slowly, you can take your tough political problems, fights between the police and the criminal, or fights between church and the state, you know, whether or not you can pray in school, or the question of whether or not legislative bodies have to redistrict themselves, or any one of the other great constitutional issues that you have seen in your lifetime. In a slow-moving society, you can take these political problems, because that's what they are, to a political body that we call a Congress or a legislature or a board of commissions. And there you can slug it out by the representatives of all of us. And we can feel that vicariously we're a part of that decision. And by the time the decision gets made, we feel that because we participated in it, that we're willing to accept it and abide by it. And it stood the test of legislative hassling back and forth. And it's probably a pretty good rule. Now, it may take 3 or 4 or 5 sessions of the legislature to accomplish that. And of course, the legislature in this state and in many states only meets once every 2 years. That means it may take you 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 years to resolve a problem, and we can't stand that in our society today. Because unless we answer certain problems in a society which is dynamic as ours is today and which is moving as rapidly as ours is today, we will simply destroy each other, or we'll drown in our own pollution, or suffocate each other, or something other cataclysmic will happen. The legislative process is simply too slow for some of these issues today, and therefore, in increasing tempo, we have cast to the United States Supreme Court the problems of prayer in school, redistricting legislative bodies, what you can do with criminals, the pollution problems, the question of whether or not you can print documents that you swipe from the government in the newspapers, political issues, every one of them, named them. We've given them to the United States Supreme Court, and we have insisted that the court answer them. And the price that you pay is an abrading of the credibility of the court. If there is a power group in the United States that the Supreme Court has not offended in the last 10 years, it's an oversight, and they'll get to them shortly. Just because we have forced the court into a position to make these decisions because of the inarticulateness of our legislative processes. The price that you pay is certain and inevitable. Sooner or later, people will say, you know, I don't believe that the United States Supreme Court was really acting according to the law. I think that's a judgment that they made themselves. And then they will say, and I don't agree with it. And it would be possible in a society like ours to live to see the day where people would go around saying things like impeach Earl Warren because he is no longer following the law. He's now using his own judgment. And we would have stopped believing our own fairy tale about the law being immutable, unchangeable, existing, and we would have been forced to the hard reality of what constitutional law is. Now I've gotten myself into a terrible box, because at this point I have said that there is no such thing as truth, and there is no such thing as right and wrong, and yes and no. You see, I have come out now with being totally tentative. What works? What's functional? What's expedient? What will most of the people buy? And that won't work. Because I've lived through Nuremberg too. And I get the same feelings you do about Smile A. It will not do to shoot people just because you happen to have them in a ditch and have an automatic weapon in your hand. It won't do, no matter how expedient it is. It won't do to engage in genocide. And there must be some ultimate right and wrong. And that gives me an opportunity to say, now let's talk for just a moment about human rights. If you visualize the scale that I was trying to draw for you for a little while, think of a parallelogram, a box, with a diagonal running through it. And down here where the line comes down to it, focus on precision of the rule, 35 miles an hour on this piece of road, large type, easily readable, three languages. I have no objection to all the policemen enforcing that all day long. And as that line diagonally goes across to the place where it's so vague and so general that nobody can know what it means, I protest vigorously that there shall not be any imprisonment and any fine. I think there the state ought only to kind of exhort and ought to talk and ought to be gentle about coercive pressures. But I'm off my scale now when I talk about human rights. I think the human right is a different thing altogether. A human right, like any other right, is one where the person who claims the right finds a person who has a corresponding duty to respond to that right. It can't be law, because there is no legislative act and there is no decision that says that I must be totally selfless, that I must love my neighbor so much that I will give my life for him. You can't write laws that way in a society which insists about everything being a exercise in reciprocity, where you exchange a quid pro quo, where if you pay me $5 and I'll give you one shirt, this is as far as you go and that's as far as I go. You can't write a human rights law in the kind of legal and constitutional structures that we've been talking about, because those structures are based upon you have a right and I have a right and we are reconciling them and making them work together with the least amount of friction. A human right is a right which belongs to a person who has no legal and who has no constitutional right. That is to say, a human right, in my opinion, is one which is possessed by a man who cannot go to any judge, to any policeman, to any administrative body, and say, enforce this for me. That citizen in Vietnam, down in the ditch, probably does not have a legal or a constitutional right not to be shot. I know of no court that can resolve the real estate problem that's involved in the invasion of Iwo Jima. We don't have an international court that can do that. We have not created a mechanism internationally that can do that. And yet I firmly believe that that person down in the ditch and those persons whose interests are involved in the invasion of nations, Vietnam, Iwo Jima, anywhere else, I believe that they have rights, and I believe that I would describe them as being human rights. And I would say then that a human right is one which a person claims out of his very weakness, the fact that he has no way of claiming the aid of a court or a legislature, but stands there totally helpless, legally and constitutionally. All that he can say is, I am a human being, and therefore you. Now what shall he say? You must give me food?
No, you can't say that.
Because you don't have to, legally. There's no action that they can bring, no judge, no military force. He cannot say, I am a human being, therefore I have a legally enforceable right against you. Can't say that. That makes nonsense. And anyone who wants to make a human right a legal right or a constitutional right is in for an argument, as far as I'm concerned. It cannot be done that way. But he can say to me, as a Christian, I am a human being. Therefore, I have a claim against you as a Christian to give me, even at your own disadvantage, and even though it can't be enforced, to give me the food and the clothing and the services and the shelter and the protection that I need to live. His claim upon me is born out of the fact that I profess, as part of my Christianity, an obligation to this person. Not enforceable in legal structures and not enforceable in constitutional structures, but rather enforceable only in that form of my Christian profession, which is to say that my responsibility is to the helpless, to the motherless, to the person who is without defense, who is the person who cannot enforce his human rights in any other fashion. Christ was a person who demonstrated the difference between legal and human rights. Christ said, don't you know I could call upon my Father for legions of angels to assert and to protect and to establish by force of angelic arms? Sounds a little strange to say it that way. But don't you know we got plenty of troops. But my kingdom is simply not a legal or a constitutional kingdom. My kingdom is not of this kind, he said, of this world. My kingdom is not military, it's not legal, it's not constitutional. My claim against you is that of a human being. I claim a human right against you. Only a Christian is responsive to human rights. I know of no other group that really professes an obligation to the weak and the helpless, except in terms of constitutionality, expediency, legality, what will work. Everybody gets a fair chance. You get your share and I get mine. And this is one reason, of course, why Christianity is frequently regarded as being a mild form of insanity, kind of a foolishness, to be a fool for Christ, to give, sacrifice, yes, Christianity, and this is being responsive to another person's human claims. Now, one more minute, and then I shall apologize for having lectured at you instead of getting you into a discussion, but that's all right. You can discuss tomorrow and the next day. You see, we're back with the prophet now, telling the people we're about to go into Babylon. Ladies and gentlemen, you've got two kinds of responsibilities when you get to Babylon. I know that you didn't arrange this trip with your travel agent, and if it weren't for the honor of the thing, you'd just as soon not be dragged off into slavery. But you're going to go, and when you get there, don't overlook the fact that your responsibilities, faithful remnant, your responsibilities, church, I'm not talking to anybody else, your responsibilities are two kinds. One, you've got to live in the world. You've got to plant crops and establish businesses and permit your sons and daughters to marry and raise children. You've got to live in a world. That's law. That's constitutionality. That's making adjustments. That's making the best of a bad situation. That's quid pro quo. That's all of those things that I try to do in my office, and I try to do them honestly, and we try to do them usefully. And then pray for the city. And that's an obligation of an entirely different kind of a dimension. But you do them both at the same time. And this is, of course, what we should mean when we talk about two kingdoms, or the doctrine of a person who lives both in Christ and in the world. and who tries to operate with the person with whom he can relate in Christianity. Because law is a way of life, just as Christianity is a way of life. That is, it's a way of living, it's a process, it's a method, it's a technique, it's a way of relating to other people, of overcoming alienation. And Christians living in the world must relate not only to other Christians with whom, to whom they can relate in love, in Christianity. And where you don't have to ask questions about, well, will the judge make me? My wife and I have not sued each other yet. Because we come somewhat closer to this model of living in love with each other. And then there are those rascals with whom I really can't bring that off. Where we do not respond to each other in this kind of selfless loving. But I must relate to that person. I must live with him. I must breathe the air. I must share the world. And to that man, I live in law. Now, thus endeth the first hour. You can cross-examine me if you like. Or else you can wait until Friday and Saturday morning. And if you're willing to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, we'll talk about it in the specifics of those units and those kinds of deviancies that we call family and that we call crime. I guess we've got somebody that's due at 10 o'clock. Is he or she here? Okay. Do you know anything more about it than that? Pardon? Oh, okay. Well, if any of you are due there, well, you can try them. You want to examine? Here I am.
Very good.
Yeah. We'll build up your ammunition and we'll take it another time.